and welcome to the Real Jaws Minute, a minute-by-minute podcast where we talk about all things Jaws. We're in season two, and today we are going to discuss the 1993 Steven Spielberg-directed classic Jurassic Park. I'm Jeremy Sternhagen.
And I'm Tyson Ferris.
And today we have a guest with us.
Joey Berner.
Joey Berner from some Jaws Minute episodes.
Yeah, I've been on a few.
Yeah, like all of them, because he did the theme music.
Yeah. You were already the most featured guest of the Jaws Minute, and now you're just piling on.
Very
yeah.
distinguished.
So we have Joey on because, for a very simple reason.
I love Jurassic Park.
Yep.
Easily in my top five movies of all time.
Top five?
Top five.
Okay. Well, we're going to get into where Jurassic Park stands in the Spielberg filmography and how it compares to Jaws, and we're going to kind of break this movie down. Scenes at a time, not minutes at a time.
Yeah. I mean, you guys know how season two is going. So, we're just going to go through this baby and, we got Joey here to, pipe in for, a lot of the music stuff,
but music.
Also his just general love for this film. Yep. He's wearing a Jurassic Park shirt right now.
Indeed.
Jeremy and I are both wearing Star Wars shirts. So you see where our loyalties lie.
I have Jaws shirts. I went Star Wars today.
This is literally what just happened. So, just for myself, and I think for everybody here, we're the point of this isn't to so much. I know a lot of these other films we've tried to go through and kind of. I think we've always kind of brought them back to Jaws, but we've been talking about them as films in general. Whereas this one, I think everybody knows this film really well, and especially anybody that's listening to a Jaws-centric podcast talk about Jurassic Park. You guys are going to want to know what we think, how these two films kind of tie together.
So. Probably more than any other movie we've watched in season two, I bet our listeners have seen Jurassic Park.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you tune into a Jaws podcast to hear a Jurassic Park commentary.
Of course. The two are forever linked.
So, kind of as we were saying before in the green room, our kind of mission statement here is to kind of tie the two films together.
And, yeah.
So if we skip over stuff that seems weird that we would skip over, it's just because it didn't seem...
there's nothing Jawsy about it.
Very Jawsy about it. So, and there's certainly a lot of Jaws in this film. So just not shark Jaws.
Yeah.
So
I'd like to start us off by hearing your Jurassic Park first viewing stories.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'm not going to go first. So, Joey.
All right. I'll jump in. Jurassic Park. So, 93.
It was 1993.
It was the summer of 1993. Yeah. So, 15 years old, somewhere in that range. And my family did not go to a lot of movies in the theater. So, usually it was the big summer blockbuster. Maybe we'll do two or three in an entire year. And so 93, the movie that we saw in the theater was Jurassic Park. And I was just blown away. I mean, even at 15, I just couldn't believe how incredible the effects were and the realism of what I was seeing. Because, you know, as we all know, like the early computer graphics just blew us away. And just the story and, of course, the music. I was already a huge John Williams fan. And this did not disappoint. In fact, my connection to Jurassic Park is... also in the CD was one of my first CDs I ever bought. So do you remember Columbia where you had to order like four and then you had to order four more. And then if you didn't like stop your subscription, they just keep sending you CDs.
Yeah.
Well, Jurassic Park was one of the first four in my very first set of CDs.
You get that for a penny?
I think it was. I think it was a penny. And
did you tape it to the thing? And
No, but I still have that CD. That is still one of my CDs in my collection, and it's still one of my all-time favorites. And I just love the movie. And every time I watch it with my kids for the first time for them, it's just always like an incredible moment. So still to this day, love it.
Yeah.
No, it's awesome.
At that point when you saw it for the first time, where was Jaws in your life at that point? Had you even seen it yet?
I had not seen Jaws.
Okay.
I had never. So Jaws, as we discussed on the podcast, as we discussed on the minutes with Jaws, my first viewing of Jaws came much later in life. It was always the video store poster on the end cap that I was like,
gotcha.
That movie looks terrifying, because I was a huge wimp. And so Jurassic Park was, yeah, came before Jaws. I had no connection to the two other than just knowing that it was Steven Spielberg doing both.
And that was my next question. Did the fact that it was Steven Spielberg, were at that point in your life, would Steven Spielberg's name attached to a movie, was that like enough? I think anybody of our age would have seen a dinosaur movie at that time regardless.
No, absolutely, because I had seen, yeah. So at that point I had seen all the Indiana Jones movies. So okay. I was
to that point.
Right. So I was a pretty big, you know, fan of those films. And of course I had seen E.T. a few years earlier and cried almost the whole way through because I was completely
as we
terrified.
All did. Yes. Is that movie is horrific for
yes.
children.
Yes. So, and I mean, you know, he had done, what, Hook the summer before?
He came, I think, right off of Hook.
Yeah.
To do this.
God, is that so, right? Is it Hook?
Yeah. Hook was before this.
Yeah. Yep.
So, I knew who Spielberg was. Of course, loved Indiana Jones. And so, yeah, I think Spielberg at that point was, you know, right at the, I mean, he was definitely on the solid, like, what am I trying to say? That not the height of his career, but he was definitely at a very solid star power director role. So, yeah, it was a draw. And I remember seeing, like, I had a friend who had the Jurassic Park book on his dining room table. His dad was reading the book. This would have been, a year or two before. And I was like, what's this? And he's like, oh, it's this book about dinosaurs and all the stuff, you know. And he was describing it. I was like, oh, that's awesome. That'll make a great movie. And then, like, I heard not too long after that, Spielberg's making it into a movie. I was like, oh,
yeah. So
fantastic.
this is our first Jaws tie-in.
There you go.
So this, just like Jaws, this was a novel that was being developed. It was bought by a studio. Tell me if this sounds familiar.
Yeah, no, it all does. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was bought by a studio for a large amount of money.
Before it was done, right?
Before it was done.
Yeah, yeah.
Just on the treatment of the book. The book was brought, and then the book was published. Out of the gates, it's going to be a major motion picture.
Before anyone had seen a page.
Before anyone
this is going to be a movie.
On
it's
concept.
It's going to be a movie.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Which is kind of understandable because it's Michael Crichton. He was a bankable author at that point and had movies developed already.
Correct. But at this point in his career, he was kind of, sorry about the table hit. did it again just to get Jer's goat. So the studio options, the book. That doesn't even option. They buy the book, the rights to the book.
I think it was $500,000.
It was.
Wasn't it?
I think it was 1.9.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
Which is insane. Like.
Especially in early 90s money.
And then on top of that, Crichton got screenwriting.
That's right.
Yeah. Money and residuals.
Yeah.
So.
So this was a big boon to his career. Apparently he had not, he was doing fine, but not great.
Yeah.
Like his career had kind of slumped. But then after this, he got asked to do, he's like, they're like, what else do you got? He's like, I got an idea for a TV show. And it was ER. And,
right.
Like,
yeah.
He was off to the races after that. And then there was all these other Crichton films that started getting made.
Yep.
Some
good, not
some good, some not so good.
Yeah.
I have a soft spot for the 13th Warrior.
So do I.
So do I. I don't have a soft spot for Congo.
I have zero soft spots for Congo. That movie is. Although. That movie, in a how did this get made way, that movie is...
Gorillas with lasers or whatever it is.
I will... The best thing that came out of Congo is the pinball machine.
Oh.
The Congo pinball machine is a great pinball. If there's any pinball aficionados out there, Congo pinball is a great pinball.
Nice.
I will try to find... I bet it's at our Portland local arcade, Ground Control.
It probably is, because it is a very good pinball. And unfortunately, it's tied to this really not great movie. anywho. But yeah, so that's our first. That's all the point I wanted to make. I feel like I went on a long walk.
Have you read
there,
Have you read the book?
I have. I did read the book before I saw the film.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah.
So I had heard there was a Spielberg film coming out called Jurassic Park, and I'm like, well, I better read the book that it's based on.
You are a better man than I.
I got about
and that that's me at like 13 years old, 14 years old.
Yeah, 93. You and I would have been 14.
Yeah.
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 So, you turned 15 would, right was, when this came out.
Yeah, it was probably the biggest. It's probably the biggest, longest book I'd ever read.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
It was like a straight up adult book that I was reading, and like got it, and I was just like, "How am I ever going to read all this?" And I did, and it was fantastic. It was amazing. I didn't
read the book for the first time until a few years ago when my wife got it for me for a birthday present, like a collector's edition of the original Jurassic Park novels from Crichton, and loved it. Although I was like, "Wow, there's so much different," but I won't go into all that. But
I have. I'll just get this out of the way.
Very, very different.
Very different, but similar to the Jaws novel in that. There's all this like melodrama with the characters that doesn't need to make it into the movie.
Yep.
The major set pieces are there in the movie, except for a couple, which they had to get rid of for budgetary reasons.
Right.
And then also like Jaws, the ending of the movie is better than the ending of the book.
Oh, totally agree.
When I read it, but I would like skim through it and be like, nope, there's no dinosaurs here. Nope, no dinosaurs. Oh, here's a dinosaur scene. Yep. So that's how I read the book.
Oh, cool.
I skimmed until I saw words that looked like there must be dinosaurs in this scene. So,
yeah, I read the whole thing cover to cover. I really loved it. I still do. And I remember being disappointed by this movie, having read the book.
Yeah.
And then going,
perspective.
Boy, this really feels like a watered down version. And it certainly is. But that was me at 14 years old going, why can't they just put this...
all these scenes in there.
Why can't they put 8 hours of Jurassic Park on the screen?
Well, side note, many of the scenes that got excised got reused in the sequels.
That's right.
Yeah.
Lost World especially. Basically, which is very similar to another Spielberg franchise, Indiana Jones.
Yeah, very...
Temple of Doom is full of many action set pieces that didn't make it in Raiders.
Yeah, remember all those mine cars in Raiders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Quick side note. I was on a Wikipedia rabbit hole today reading about Steven Spielberg and Jurassic Park. And everyone knows I'm a big defender of Temple of Doom.
Yep.
I'm just going to take this opportunity to throw down that both Roger Ebert and Pauline Kael said that Temple of Doom is awesome. And I think they even said it might be better than Raiders. So I'm just throwing that out there. All right, let's move on.
That's a hot, little hot take.
We should move on because we haven't got to the first scene of this movie.
Yeah, well, we haven't got to your Jurassic Park experience or mine.
Oh, yeah. So mine was, I think I went to the Evergreen Cinemas in Hillsboro. And it was a brand new cinema. They had DTS.
Oh, yeah. This is the
I'm pretty sure that this is where I watched it as well. I'm sure
you were there at the same time.
Yeah,
the first DTS movie.
First DTS movie.
Oh, that's right.
And I remember that was a big deal. And you could tell it was different.
I couldn't. My theater didn't have DTS, but we'll get to that.
Well, anyway, you could tell. I could tell it was different. It was just. It was just.
Yeah.
It was rumblier. Like it got in your, it got in your guts. It rumbled them around a little bit.
An idea I had that before we did this podcast tonight is that we'd go into my theater and watch just the opening scene, but I can't because got some kiddos sleeping upstairs.
Yeah,
but so. It'd be fun.
Anyhow, and I had a weird. The first time I watched it, I felt I had a weird like I love this, and yet I'm disappointed at the same time, like. Mm. That was my initial walkout. Was I really loved this film, and I'm kind of disappointed that it wasn't more like the book. Mm. So that was just me at 14 years old. Me now, I would have been like, oh, I see what they did there and there and there and there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, that makes sense. And
you came into it with expectations.
Mm. I did come in with very much expectations and was disappointed. So, yeah. This movie has just groaning. Even today at 4x speed, doing my notes, because I have a kid at home and I got to get through it fast. It's so good. It's such a good film. It's not without some...
Jeremy.
It still has some missteps, but I really like this film. Yeah. I really do.
Yeah.
How about you?
All right. So I saw this... I can't remember if it was opening night, but it would have been for sure opening weekend. There was a lot of buildup for this movie, obviously. And I saw it in Bozeman in the Ellen Theater, which I've mentioned on this podcast before. And... Tyson knows it.
I've been to the Ellen.
Grand, like, almost
old timey.
Yeah, it was built as like a playhouse, like an opera house. It's very grand. Saw many movies there, and it was a sold out show. And I remember because I was in the front row, extreme right, literally the worst seats in the house. However, that meant my entire viewing experience was like looking up at these dinosaurs. I would have been 14. I was probably seeing it with my friends, and I remember being excited, but also I can honestly say I think I already knew at that point, like, dinosaurs, like, I think I'm, like, my childhood fascination with mm-hmm. dinosaurs was already kind of waning, so I think even at that time I was like, I think I'm, like, 5 years old, too old for this movie. also, at 14, you're at this age where you're too cool for anything, right? So I went to it, and my experience was actually very similar to Tyson's. I hadn't read the book at that time, and I watched it, and I have two distinct memories. That the first half of the movie, like, you get the Brachiosaurus 15 minutes in, then there's a bunch of talking, and I remember about halfway through the movie going, like, this movie's not going to have any dinosaurs in it. And what's funny is I distinctly remember the line of Jeff Goldblum saying, are you planning to have dinosaurs on your dinosaur tour? I remember actually going, like, yeah.
Yeah, movie.
Like, thank you, Jeff, for making the joke I'm thinking.
But and then, couldn't you argue, are you going to have any sharks in your shark movie?
I would have seen Jaws
probably
at this
not.
Point.
Yeah.
Jaws is such a different movie, and boy, we're going to get into that.
You can make the comparison, though, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I didn't think that in Jaws.
Sure.
Because there's every 15 minutes there is shark in Jaws. At least every 15 minutes there's shark. I think I'm getting way ahead of myself because here. I don't want this to be me bashing Jurassic Park, but a lot of my memories and thoughts around this movie center around my frustration and disappointment for how much I want this movie to be just a little better than it is. So I love Jurassic Park. I'll just say that up front. But there's going to be a lot of butts.
Hold on to your butts.
Hold on to your butts. My line, I quote a lot. My biggest takeaway from this movie was that the second half is full of killer set pieces, but my biggest memory of this movie is at the end of the movie, which the movie gets started, we got dinosaurs, helicopters flying, and I'm like, all right, here we go. Directed by Steven Spielberg. It's over? Like, I remember so vividly so
that
credit
was the
coming
start.
Up on the screen and being, like, punched in the gut by this movie going, that's it? Like, that was my big takeaway from the first time I saw Jurassic Park going, it's over?
Wow.
Really?
2 hours You're is done? Not enough for Jeremy.
So there's one other...
You could argue that. Yeah. And I don't... But that's a testament to the movie is... I remember, like, kind of wanting more dinosaurs early on, but then at 2 hours in, as a viewer in the audience, I'm going, let's go. Let's, like, I'm ready for more at 2 hours in. So this movie could have been 3 hours, and I would have been hook, line, and sinker. Like, it wasn't losing me. I was just so excited for there to be more.
So I have to give you another quick little personal story, and you can use this or not, because it's actually more related to The Lost World. But here's what happened. So I'll just say this. So I already loved Jurassic Park, and then mm-hmm. in college, The Lost World was coming out, and I was
98 or 99.
Yeah, yeah, something like. Yeah.
97. It was 97. Yeah. I remember because
I was so excited for the sequel to Jurassic Park. So yeah. excited for this. And I was dating what is now my wife. And you know, when you're a poor college kid and you're like, okay, we're going to do one really big date. Like we're going to go all in.
Just for my edit, the lady who is now my wife.
What did I? Oh, I was dating.
You just said, what is now my wife?
Well, the lady who is now
my wife. You know that thing?
The beautiful young woman I was dating in college, who is now my wife.
There you go.
As poor college kids, we had this one, like, we're going to have one big date night. And we went to the fanciest restaurant at the top of the whatever big building it was in Boise, and we had a big fancy dinner, and we wore our nicest clothes, and then we went to the Egyptian theater, which sounds similar to what you're describing, mm-hmm. where it was all decked out like an Egyptian tomb inside, and we watched The Lost World, and it was this very visceral memory of that night, and it sort of solidified Jurassic Park as one of my favorite things. Now, I was terribly disappointed in the movie, but the night itself was amazing. Mm-hmm. And then the other last piece is, and as a home theater person, I think Jeremy, you'll appreciate this. A couple years later, when the DVDs came out for the first time, and your DTS story reminded me. Do you remember when you had to pick? You either bought the DVD with DTS or Dolby Digital. You couldn't get both because it was too much data on the disc. Mm-hmm. And I bought the non-DTS because I didn't have a DTS receiver. But the theater owner of the owner of the home theater company I worked for, they bought the DTS version to show off. And it was the one with the bass track that was wrong. Do you remember that?
I remember that.
The bass track, it was like gone.
The first pressing of Jurassic Park was recalled.
Yeah.
Because it had no bass.
So, and we used to use my DTS copy, we used to use that as our test scene once we got a system set up. Mm-hmm. And that was it. It was like from then on, Jurassic Park was just
it elevated it in your mind.
Yeah,
have
for
it
sure.
Demo.
For
disc.
Sure. All right. Those are my Jurassic Park
stories. My demo thing, anytime I'd like move houses and like reset up, is I'd put in the DVD of The Matrix and the.
The lobby?
The lobby into the.
Bullet time.
Yeah. On the top of the roof, just because you could really hear the surround work in that scene.
Yep.
And I still believe that's a very good test of a system.
It's good.
So anyway, sorry.
Okay, so we know when we first saw Jurassic Park, and we know our general feelings on it.
Yep.
Yes, let's get into this bad boy. So this great opening scene.
Before you get to the opening scene, I have notes on the opening logo.
Ooh. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
All right.
Jeez Louise.
Sorry.
Sorry, guys. I tried to get us into this movie, but apparently we're going to get railroaded by Jeremy.
Super fast. Okay. So my memory of this opening logo was that it was the first time this brand new Universal logo was introduced. Ooh. I was wrong. The very first movie to use this new style Universal logo, which we all recognize as different from the Jaws Universal logo.
Sure.
So the Jaws Universal logo had been in place for the longest period that Universal ever used any one logo, from 1963 until 1990.
It's my Universal logo.
Yes, I always think of the Jaws Universal logo as the Universal logo.
Yeah.
The first movie to introduce this logo that we see on Jurassic Park, any guesses?
1990.
I'll just cut right to it. Back to the Future, Part 3. First movie to introduce this logo.
That kind of bugs me.
Yeah,
can't they all have the same logo?
No.
You know what would be even better is if they had used the period appropriate Universal logo.
For the 1950s?
Or the
1800s for Back to the Future 3?
There is a Universal logo that goes back not quite to 1885, but to like 1910, anyway. An interesting side note, the company that created this graphic that you see in Jurassic Park is the same company that did both the Paramount logo and the 20th Century Fox logo redos around the same time. And the score that normally accompanies this logo was done by James Horner, but of course this one is silent, mimicking Jaws. which also has sounds of nature and
interesting
and a slowly building
went back to the well a little
and
bit.
A slowly building John Williams score.
Yes,
nice.
So
see how I jazzed that right there.
I see how you jazzed that. I like the jazz is now a verb.
Yep.
So this great opening scene, as I was saying, this scene, and I know you're not gonna like this, Joe, but this scene always feels like a soundstage to me. It never feels like we're in a place. Like it just seems so soundstagey to me, and I can never quite put my finger on what it is, but it just never feels. And there's certainly other scenes that are very soundstagey,
right?
That I completely
you buy them.
Buy that that we're on Kauai and it's not a different T-Rex paddock in a soundstage at night, you know, like you know. But we'll get to
it's
that later.
It's highly stylized relative to the rest of the movie. And my thoughts on this, like, the rest of the movie is
Maybe it's just a stylization that's
the rest
like,
of the movie is clearly, for the most
part,
on location. Like, they are in Hawaii. This is, like, stands out as, like, we're in a different movie.
Yeah.
Like, you don't catch it if you've seen watching it for the first time because you're just like, this is the start of Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And you don't know the movie you're about to get into.
Right.
But relative to the rest of the movie,
it feels weird,
It feels weird, and... Yeah. Sorry, Joey. I'm going to crush your Jurassic Park.
It's all right.
This scene, unlike the opening scene in Jaws, has nothing to do with the rest of the movie. It's
No. See, I disagree there.
I mean, loosely.
I disagree. Because this is basically our Chrissy scene.
Yeah.
But it doesn't directly play into the Chrissy scene in Jaws is a catalyst that kicks off the narrative of the entire movie. What we're seeing now is just, well, probably when Jurassic Park was getting built, some random park workers.
I think
it's setting up the lethality.
Yeah, how dangerous it is.
And just exactly what we're getting into.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's doing it without showing us any dinosaurs, which is why I think it is very much the Chrissy scene of Jurassic Park.
It totally is. It's definitely our first. We're struck. It's how.
And you get Shota.
Yes.
Here's what I will say on this scene.
If there is a Quint in this film, it is Muldoon.
It is Muldoon, for right? sure.
Which is a shame because he could be in the movie so much more than he is. I want more of him.
I certainly want more of Muldoon, for sure. He's fantastic.
I am not opposed to the idea of opening your movie with a velociraptor attack where you don't see the velociraptor. I like the concept. I just feel like, I don't know, I just want more out of it. I don't know what more looks like.
I don't know what you want, but I love that it's so fast, which I don't even think physically, like, I don't think physics works this way.
No. Yeah. I know what you're saying.
If something pushes off of a thing,
it's like it's the box
that is inside of
sliding out from under
him. It can't slide out from under him because it's like the fly in the rail car, right?
Yeah.
It's moving with the rail
right. car. Yeah. It's not moving 90 miles an hour. It's moving, you know, relative
so
to
what, the So what we've decided is Jeremy, you're wrong.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what we're...
This is not a movie I'm going to go to the mat on like I will on, say, Temple of Doom.
No, you've already said you're out to get this film and
I enjoy it. Here's
from the inside.
Here's where I'm coming from in this whole movie is this movie often gets mentioned as similar to / equal than, and in some people's view, better than Jaws.
Mm.
Where I'm going to come from during this whole podcast is Jaws is better.
Mm.
It's not even close.
Well, I don't even think we need to keep arguing that. Right. Jaws is better than this film. It just is.
There are people that don't agree.
This film is really, really good. It's really good. It's way better than my 14-year-old self gave it credit for. I will say that. So our next scene, we get Satipo, and he's all grown up.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a cameo.
From Raiders.
Yeah.
Alfred Molina.
Yeah. Yep. Right. I mean, could you... That's obviously on purpose, right? Maybe just coincidence?
I actually... I think when I was watching this today, I was thinking, like, is he in one of the Indiana Jones? He's in one of the Indiana Jones, isn't he? And I thought it might have been him, but that's Alfred Molina.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Just looks
Could they get a guy that looks more like Alfred Molina?
Why didn't they just get Alfred Molina? little inside?
Yeah.
Little anyway, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
I just saw that and I was like, God, I remembered that guy, but I did not remember him looking just like Satipo. So anyway, so then we get, we go to the dig site and unless you guys got more.
Nah.
Yeah. So we go to the dig site. Computers are going to put people out of their jobs. And I think there's a underlying theme that has a duality
for sure
in this film.
Yeah.
That computers are going to put paleontologists out of their, or archaeologists out of their job, whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. But also there's a subtext that CGI is going to put people out.
That's
of
one
jobs.
Of the big behind the scenes stories of this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is how it was, Phil Tippett, famous animatronic stop motion animator who had been part of Star Wars mm-hmm. and a lot of mm-hmm. Lucas and Spielberg stuff, how they had just started developing stop motion for Jurassic Park. And when the first CGI test came back, they were like, well, we're done here.
Yeah.
Stop motion is over.
I was going to say, I almost thought that was a quote of his, or not a quote, but he made a similar statement that they worked into the movie. Like, you know, we're going to be put out of a job. And it's kind of a very meta moment in the film.
Looks like we're out of a job. Don't you mean extinct?
Yeah, I think that is literally was literally a back and forth between Tippett and Spielberg.
But for what it's worth, they did end up using Phil Tippett's work.
That's right.
Because they animated the dinosaurs and used it as the
modeling. What they did is they took the little armatures and they actually put motion capture rods inside of them so they could actually move them rather than doing mouse and keyboard and stuff
kind
like
of brilliant.
That. They could actually move them by hand and that would equate into the program. So they could actually animate. So they were all animated, but all the CG models were animated by hand.
So what they didn't realize is they were doing is that that's kind of how CG is still done today. They still like to motion capture a performer
mm-hmm.
before they animate, if they can.
Yeah. Right? So it's almost always, whether it's done by hand or whether it's done by physicality of an actor or something, it's almost always captured in a different way rather than it being completely built in a computer. So...
The place that this movie holds in history, like if you're making a documentary about the evolution of film,
mm-hmm.
like Jurassic Park is like the, along with like The Abyss and Terminator 2.
Well, along with Jaws, like.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Like Steven Spielberg has two.
There's two movies. There's two films. Sorry, I'm.
Yeah, two films in his films in his film history where it's just like and everything changed here.
Yeah.
And one of them is Jaws, and one of them is Jurassic Park. Correct. No doubt about it.
No doubt.
And I mean, you can't tell the Jurassic Park story without mentioning Terminator 2 and The Abyss because
they did precede.
They did precede with that kind of effects work.
But not like this,
yeah. Right? Yeah. I didn't look up the exact numbers, but one of my favorite little bits of movie trivia is that both Terminator 2, The Abyss, and Jurassic Park, the amount of screen time of actual CG in all three of these movies for all three is like less than 5 minutes. Like all three of them have very little CG.
Yeah, my understanding, I did some real looking into that. I think there's 14 minutes of dinosaurs in this
two-hour movie.
Hmm.
And most of it is animatronic.
Yeah, and yeah. It's I think it's 4 minutes of CG dinosaurs.
Wow. 4, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Terminator 2 is even less.
It took them...
Yeah, I don't remember any CGI dinosaurs in Terminator 2.
By the way, those four minutes...
Good one.
Those 4 minutes to... it was something like 2.5 to 3 days to render a single frame.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you think about what 4 minutes means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
And it holds up.
It does hold up really hard. Yeah, it holds up so well because literally the we'll get there. I'll get to this.
I was going to say from just in that scene when he touches the computer and the screen and there's some of those interactions with the old technology. I love that kind of stuff. I love seeing it just sort of like a time warp for me and like seeing an old TV and I love that cardboard they've got to shield it and it just feels so like so visceral this like. Old technology and the way it sort of, it's kind of a crummy
cardboard
picture.
Hood. That's exactly what...
like a movie production.
Yeah, I mean,
that's what they would use.
When I'm on set now, those are actually built into monitors.
Right.
So you can shield the sun from reflecting on your screen.
Another double meaning of, the computer's putting the filmmakers out of a job is that's kind of a through line through the movie, how nature versus computers... Basically, the failings of computers
technology,
in this movie and technology is what allows the dinosaurs to do their thing.
Absolutely.
And we're jumping way ahead.
Yes. I was just pointing out to go, hey, theme. So Grant's speech here sets up a lot of things. It sets up his kid problem. It sets up how a T-Rex works.
Oh, when he's talking to young Chris Pratt?
Yeah.
Young Chris Pratt.
Oh, that's mean.
Been a joke that I think that some people theorize that that's the young Chris Pratt.
Supposed to be Chris Pratt later.
For Jurassic later Jurassic World. Parking, which is not, it's not possible and they don't set it up that way. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, so Grant's speech sets up his kid problem, how a T-Rex works.
Yeah.
The motion vision. How a raptor works, how they hunt. And this is, I thought this is very similar to Hooper in Jaws.
Mm. Grant is Hoopering the heck out of this.
A little bit of foreshadowing, a little bit of explanation.
He's like, and I don't think you'll, he's like, all it wants to do is,
Swim. And eat.
And eat.
And make,
and
little,
make little baby sharks.
And that's all.
And that's all. It's a perfect machine. Yeah. Anyway.
One of my favorite lines in this scene is, if you wanted to scare the kid, you could have just pulled a gun on him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great line.
It's a good line. There's so many good lines in this film.
So is Grant more the Hooper character to you? Or
in this moment, he's very Hooper-ish.
Yeah.
I think overall in the movie, he's a Brody.
Yeah, see, I was
just in his arc.
I was thinking about the introduction of Grant versus Brody and kind of just sort of how they compare and contrast. Yeah.
If we have to get it, if we have to go to the very end of my notes, I go, Grant is to kids as Brody is to water.
Ah, very nice. True. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, the analogies aren't perfect.
If I'm doing my SAT.
But that one is. Your SAT.
That was not on my SATs. I would have got a much better score.
One thing I'll quick throw in here is the character that Grant is modeled after, and he was also an advisor on the movie, is James Horner. Jack Horner?
Jack Horner.
Jack Horner.
Who is a prominent scientist in this field, who is also...
Paleontologist,
who is based out of University of the Rockies and Montana State University, Bozeman, Montana.
Hey. Look at that.
And the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, if you want to go to the dinosaur museum in the country, besides the Smithsonian, it's Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman.
Well, I think in the behind-the-scenes stuff on the Blu-ray, they're in Montana, right?
Yep. This scene was not filmed in Montana.
It's
supposed to take place there.
Okay.
I remember in the audience seeing this movie for the first time, there's a line in the previous scene where they say something like, you'll never get Grant out of Montana. And the audience going, yay.
It's so then we cut to Nedry. It's we're getting very to my eyes a very similar Mayor Vaughn shady stuff.
Mm, indeed.
Yeah, kind of just setting that up.
And the outrageous shirt.
And the outrageous shirt
kind of goes with the anchor jacket.
We're talking about
the barbersaw scene.
Okay. Yeah.
We got Dotson here.
Dotson here. Yeah, with Wayne Knight.
Yeah.
Newman.
Yeah. Anyway, great scene. That's all I really got to say about it. As far as Jaws goes.
This scene is funny to me, but also you don't need it. You can set up,
I think you do.
You can set up his character as being up to something schemey and nefarious without setting up his specific, like, it's this much money and here's the plan and here's what he's going to do. And I don't know. This all serves to my earlier point of like, let's go movie, come on, let's get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
But it's a funny scene.
It is a fun scene. Also, Costa Rica does not look like that.
I've never been there. I wouldn't know, but I bet you that scene was shot in Hawaii.
Hawaii.
I did look up online that they did do location shooting in Costa Rica.
Well, my wife lived in Costa Rica for a considerable amount of time. And
she goes,
that is not what Costa Rica looks like.
I wonder what part of the movie is Costa Rica. She goes,
that's what rural Hawaii looks like.
Well, there you go.
So,
I personally love that scene. I love the I love the setup. I love the shaving cream and the
barbersol
can and all. I just
the bit where he puts it on top of the pie. Yeah. I mean, there's just so much good stuff in there. I think it's in there just because they're like, this is gold. Like, it's just.
I think they shot a scene and Steven Spielberg was like, I love Wayne Knight. Spielberg sought out Wayne Knight for this movie.
Yeah. He's great in it.
Yeah.
I heard the other alternate, which is such an alternate, is Charlie Sheen.
Oof.
Nedry.
I can go for that.
I honestly could see it, but it would be a very different.
Very different.
Yeah.
Do you guys know who Spielberg's first choices were for Grant and his Nellie? Muldoon's character?
Oh, Muldoon?
Yeah. Do you know who his first choices were?
I know Harrison Ford was in there.
Yep.
I don't know if he was his first choice.
They actually either auditioned or
Harrison straight up turned it down.
Yeah, but he was first choice.
Yeah.
And first choice for Ellie was Robin Wright.
Robin Wright, wow.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Yeah, The Princess Bride.
I could see that.
Yeah. Can you imagine Harrison Ford, Robin Wright, and Charlie Sheen in this movie?
See, I think that's one of the things I loved about the movie from the cast perspective is other than, you know, Jeff Goldblum, who, of course, now is a huge star. And
he would have been the biggest star.
Yeah, but that's what I loved about it.
And David Attenborough to a certain demographic, but yeah.
But like
at the time, I mean, these are all second-tier actors,
exactly.
Right?
But to me, that felt more real, right? It felt like, oh, I don't know these characters. Like watching Harrison Ford at that point, you're watching a Harrison Ford movie.
100%.
And that's where I actually think there's a strength in that casting is that, hey.
Well, Harrison Ford even said that he turned it down thinking he wasn't right for the role.
Yeah.
He just thought Spielberg was wrong, and then so he just didn't do it. And then he watched the film and was like, yep.
Oops.
No.
Oh, he agreed?
He was like, yep, I was totally right. I am not supposed to be in this picture.
My personal choice would be, I like the casting they went with. Or I like the fact that they didn't go with name actors.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I saw this, here's a side story. You mentioned earlier long books that you read.
Mm-hmm.
The longest book I had ever read at this point in my life would have been The Hunt for Red October. Because I love that movie. I read the book prior to the movie. Saw the movie. And at that age of my life, you know, every movie I saw was my favorite movie of all time. But I remember seeing Hunt for Red October and loving it. And the big standout in that movie for me was Sam Neill. Partially because one of his story arc things in Hunt for October is that when they are defecting to the United States, he wants to live in Montana. And so as a 12-year-old watching Hunt for October, the character who wants to live in Montana, me little nobody watching in Montana, I'm like, I like that guy. So I had a thing for Sam Neill, thinking he was a cool dude
right
when I saw Jurassic Park for the first time.
I had no
call. Well, and then Sam and Sam Neill was auditioned for Indiana Jones.
Really?
And James Bond.
I don't think I knew that. James Bond.
He tried out for both. There's you can watch his audition, his auditions for James Bond. They're a bonus feature on like the Octopussy or View to a Kill. Like that's when he was trying out. Was in the mid '80s.
Yeah. So. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah, he might have been the alternative Dalton.
Timothy Dalton.
Yeah. He would. Yeah.
Anyhow.
Cool. Anyway, Sam Neill, good casting. Laura Dern, good casting. The rest of the cast, even better casting.
Yeah, I would say if you put both the both Jaws and Jurassic Park next to each other, I would argue that Jurassic Park has a finer cast
than Jaws.
Than Jaws.
Wow.
How do you come by that?
I just think it's just got more heavy hitters than Jaws does.
Okay.
I don't think there's a lot of side by sides that Jurassic Park wins, but I think might be one of them.
I'm not gonna disagree, but I guess I think what's harder for me is the characters they play. Have far more depth than Jaws, so I think I have a hard time separating the actor from the character.
There's more of them and they all have depth in Jurassic Park.
Really?
A little bit.
That's in my notes as being the exact opposite of
that. Oh, really?
Interesting. I got to dig through my notes. But basically, one note I have is any scene with Jeff Goldblum is pure gold. His dialogue, characterization stands out in a movie otherwise filled with stereotypes.
Wait, we haven't even seen him yet.
I know. We're to his first scene
That's
now.
True. Yeah, that's
the
true.
The helicopter.
I would say he is, but I think he's fantastic in anything he does.
But this is really...
I've always liked him, and he's like now, I think in the last couple of years, he's shot up like... to my top 1% of actors. But the scenes that he's in makes all the other actors around him better. Like, I like the other actors more when they're in a scene with him.
It's pretty transcendent.
And when I say the other characters are stereotypes, it's more like they're just vessels for exposition. That's kind of the purpose that a lot of the other characters serve. And that's true of a lot of movies. Mm. But any movie, like, is Jeff Goldblum in anything where he isn't just like... magnetic, like that's just what he does.
But it's also kind of like who he is, right? You watch him in any even shows where he's not a character. Like I don't know if you've seen him on that Disney Plus series that got for National Geographic.
It's fantastic.
Like, it's very good, but it's also like uber Jeff Goldblum. Like he's in manic mode. So I was going to ask. So I was not as movie literate, I think, as you as a young person. So this, for me, was my first Jeff Goldblum movie that I remember. Like, I think I saw The Fly on TV, like, parts of it, because I remember the scene when he becomes The Fly and it was, like, super gross and stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm curious because, for me, this is sort of where he really was on the map. Like, you knew him before, but this was, like, now he's a star. Is that fair?
I think he was a star before this. I don't think he was...
He was not a huge star, but
he was definitely supporting, if not even leading.
This actually, where I'll put this movie in, is in most of his movies. So he was largely a supporting player until the mid to late 80s, and most of the movies he was in from the late 80s till this movie came out, he was either the lead or part of an ensemble.
Sure.
His first big introduction would have been Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is 12 years before this. Yeah. But that didn't necessarily put him in like the A-list category. But The Fly was really his major like arrival movie. But it was also he was firmly in the genre category at that point. Another one he would be in movies like Earth Girls Are Easy. Mm. He's in Into the Night, which is that really weird John Landis movie that we actually guested on for Minute by Minute.
Yep.
And I know there's been a lot of like weird romantic comedies and weird dramas had preceded this. But this was like his, I'm sure this was his by far his most high profile.
Oh, this is for sure his like big.
high budget.
Is this would he be sort of like
this is the biggest movie he's ever been in, for sure.
Yeah, maybe I don't know how Thor did, but the Thor movie he's in, Thor Ragnarok, but this was a billion-dollar movie in 1993. It took it a few years to hit a billion, but anyway, still is his biggest movie anyway.
Yeah, I think my understanding is it didn't hit a billion until actually the 3D re-release.
There you go.
So yeah, but it still made a lot of money.
It was the highest grossing movie. What did it replace?
Let's put it this way: this movie on points, back in points,
mm-hmm.
made Steven Spielberg $250 million.
Yeah,
for one movie.
Good on you. So here's a.
That's on top of whatever he got paid
probably,
to make the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
So is.
That's unheard of, by the way.
Biggest budget, biggest grossing movie of all time, replacing what as the biggest grossing movie
Ooh,
of all
I
time?
Used to know this.
E.T.
It was still E.T. at that time?
It replaced E.T. as the biggest grossing movie of all time. This movie held the record for like 4 or 5 years, got replaced by Titanic. Yep. And Titanic got replaced by Avatar.
So do you think he's the Richard Dreyfuss of this film?
I think he's the nobody Jaws of this movie.
Oh, I think he's
more Hooper than anybody.
I think he's more Hooper than anybody. Yeah. I think he's pointing out I think there's a lot of characterization that's Hooper. It's pointing out, you know, I don't think you're going to deal with the problem until it comes up and bites you in the ass.
Right.
That's basically what he's saying.
Right.
He's the
scene.
I told you this was going to happen.
I told you this was going to happen.
But I wonder even from
those are impact tremors. This makes me very concerned.
but even from
the best lines in the movie by Country Mile,
the most quotable, right?
Yep.
But what about even just from outside the film? Like, I feel like there's kind of a parallel there. With I remember, Jaws was really one of those movies that Richard Dreyfuss leveraged for a lot of his future roles, and I feel like Jeff Goldblum, same kind of deal, right?
Absolutely.
There were a lot of things that came after Jurassic Park that probably wouldn't have happened if he hadn't been in that character.
100%. I think. I can't remember which actor said it, but I think I've actually heard multiple actors say it. But if you can get a role in a Spielberg anything, whatever
you take it right,
whatever his name is on it, it's going to get you four more roles.
It's going to springboard you.
It's going to springboard you into something. And then if you don't get anything after that, well, then that's your fault. But. But yeah, if you can get your name on to a Spielberg thing, it's a good thing.
In this scene, I have to jump in on the music because I think this is one of my favorite cues, right?
Oh, 100%.
When it cuts to that chopper shot and the music just soars. And I don't know if it was an the Art of the Score podcast, but there's somewhere where they talked about John Williams being the ultimate writer of flying music. If you need music for flying, whether it's, you know, a person flying or an airplane or a helicopter, he just soars, right? Star Wars, all the music that when ships are flying, and I think this one just nails it, and it's such a great, just launches you in. It feels like to me this is where the movie really starts.
You're right. And my thoughts on the music in this scene is this is the scene where suddenly the score becomes E.T. It's you mentioned
there
flying.
You go flying music.
This, this is very reminiscent, and I'm not saying this is kind of a backhanded compliment. This music, it has like a lot of the same elements of the flying theme from E.T.
For sure,
it has the I'm sorry for being horrible at imitating orchestral music, but it's doing the. And then
it's funny that you you thought it was E.T. I thought it made me it when I was listening to it, and maybe this was in 4x speed,
it's a little different.
By the way, everything sounds different. it honestly dumbs down things a lot, and you can kind of hear consistencies and things.
Sure.
And you're like, oh, because you're only hearing beats and it kind of smooths everything.
If there's a lower bass line, you hear that rhythm of the it's going, you hear whatever that is.
Yeah.
in a way prominent way.
Anyway, so it was very interesting looking at it that way. But what it reminded me of when they got to the helicopter and it's that big crescendo, you know, mm-hmm. thing of them going to the island, and it reminded me of the asteroid field.
Sure. Yeah. There's a lot of that in there.
And so that's what I heard, but honestly, it was in four times. Yeah. So maybe it was just asteroid field
maybe,
slowed down.
Exactly. He just took the asteroid field off. If I slow that down, no one will notice.
Yeah.
You don't know.
So,
and that's what I think, and now that you mention asteroid field, I think that's what I'm saying too, is that they're structurally similar and that has this like high string or flute,
mm-hmm.
like doing this, which asteroid field is, and then a lower And then the melody is.
But
at
isn't
a lower...
that the flying? Isn't that the soaring part? Is the
yeah? There's
the,
always
the
those
strings, those harps, and going. Da, 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 da,
yeah, it's
da,
kind of that Tinkerbell, flying, tinkling sound right. underneath, and there's then
and then
sweeping
kind
strings,
of sweeping yep. strings. Yep. Yeah.
I'll say this now because it'll contextualize any further thoughts I have on this score. Is that like most John Williams scores? It's fantastic, but I also feel like. Similar to Spielberg's direction in mm-hmm. this movie is that it's almost like you know Spielberg's beats, you know his style, like there's a at this mm-hmm. point in his career there's a Spielberg style, there's a John Williams style
oh, sure.
mm-hmm. and this movie to me feels like a greatest hits sort of like oh, I know what John Williams does. It's this. And most of this, I think this score has some great themes in it, but it has sort of a feeling of like, yeah, I like that, but I liked it better when it was in this movie. And there's almost every piece of music in this movie, except for one, I can call out as, oh, that's kind of... this other piece of John Williams movie mm-hmm. music, or even another like classical score piece that he's heavily borrowing on. Sure. And everybody knows John Williams kind of stands on the shoulders of musical giants, right?
Sure. Well, and even borrows. And even on the shoulders of John Williams.
right.
Yeah.
And maybe I should wait till we get to the scene because I have a single piece of music in this movie that I love.
Oh, there's lots more we could talk about. But
yeah.
For sure.
Well,
keep going.
We're just starting to touch on the music, so we don't have to get into every single part of it right
this
now.
This is going
to
be the most stream of
I'm
consciousness.
I'm just trying to get us out of the helicopter, guys. Come on.
You're way too stuck on
the seatbelt.
Chronology of this movie. Oh, the seatbelt
I love that
tying.
Part.
Ugh. Oh, that is the most meaningful scene.
I have a note on it.
Setting up the concept of the movie.
I'm just trying to help.
Yeah.
Just trying to
help. He takes two female belt buckles
mm-hmm.
and ties them together.
Oh, there's double meaning there. There's, okay. Yeah. I never equated the yeah.
Yes.
Gotcha. I didn't notice it until this viewing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I knew.
Two female belt buckles.
It's not working.
It's not working. Ties them together. Now, life finds a way.
Yep. So we have the helicopter has landed, and they are about to see some dinosaurs.
No, wait a minute. We have to talk about the Jeeps.
Hey, Joey, what about the Jeeps?
I love these Jeeps. So. We have to talk about the Jeeps. Uh-huh. This is a little side nerd passion.
Yeah.
I love movies.
I think we have one here on the table.
I brought my toy Jurassic Park Jeep, one of several. One of my side nerd hobbies is to collect toy versions of movie cars, right? So all the classic, mostly in the 80s, there are lots of great television and movie cars. And I think in some ways this is one of the last great movie cars. Mid-90s Jurassic Park Jeep. It's iconic. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole nerdy subculture. I don't know if you've ever seen these people. They're great, not just nerds. They're wonderful people, I'm sure,
mm-hmm.
that take their Jeep Wranglers and paint them just like a Jurassic Park Jeep. And the thing about it is, if you look at these Jeeps, there were only two model years. And you got to understand, I'm a Land Rover guy. That's my choice. But this is my one exception. Mm-hmm. I do love these Jeeps. But there were two model years. I believe it was 92 and 93. Maybe there's a little fuzzy on that had the square headlights. And that's when this movie was made. And thus the Jeeps that are used? Are they very rare square headlighted Jeep Wranglers?
Because almost all Jeeps are round headlights.
Correct. They're round. So yeah. So
it's
you see
part of their branding and logo.
That's yeah. right. That's right. So these were the anomaly that happened to get captured in that time period when they made the movie. And so if you now own a 93 Jeep Wrangler Sahara mm-hmm. in whatever tannish color it is, everybody assumes you're going to paint that as a Jurassic Park Jeep. And there's a huge group. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of these Jeeps all over Instagram and Facebook. And they have, in fact, there's a couple driving around the Portland area. I see that.
I love that.
I've seen them.
And so I love these Jeeps. Every time I see one, I just, these scenes of them and the Jeeps driving through the island.
And then, of course, fantastic. There's the far easier to replicate Ford.
Ford Explorer. We'll get into that a little bit too. I'll mention the Ford Explorer.
I took some time out of my day to drive all the way over to Hillsboro.
That's right. With a gift in hand.
A car that cost me less than a dollar.
I'm sure the gas you burned was more.
No, it was just out of love.
Yeah.
But I saw it and I bought it and I was like, there's a man that has to have it. And yeah,
proudly in my collection.
Leaving the store, so they proudly. I could not. It was crazy. It was a stupid thing, but all out of love. And
this is how we love each other.
And that's right.
And nerddom and all those good things. So anyway.
All right. Yeah. Sorry, I just had to talk about the Jeep.
All right. Where are we here?
The helicopter just landed.
Oh, yeah. So Hammond here, he's talking to his lawyer. I think he's very Mayor Vaughn in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I'll shut he's you like, down, John.
He's like, I'll shut you down, John. He's like, no, you're not going to shut. You're going to be the one that's offering me the apology. I know what's going on. I got all the things. I got all the cards. I got all the things. So it's very Vaughn. So that's all I had to say about that.
He is the ruling authority over this particular geography, so he's definitely the Vaughn.
Wants things to succeed.
Movie. Yes.
Doesn't want a bad press to get out.
He doesn't come off quite as I think Mayor Vaughn comes off as trying to do the right thing in Jaws, as does Hammond. Neither of them are like out to really be bad guys.
Mm. I got a little, there's a little thing that I never caught in this film.
Okay.
And it's John Hammond's, and I never noticed it until this last viewing, and it's his spared no expense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is not him bragging. I think it is compensation and him knowing that that's actually not what
true.
He did.
Yeah.
Because I think there's tons of evidence in this film that he
spared a few expenses.
He spared lots of expenses.
Yeah. That's comparable to Vaughn going, we've caught and killed a large predator that supposedly injured some bathers.
Yeah.
But as you can see, it's a beautiful day.
Yeah, yeah.
Beaches
yeah.
are open.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Right.
Yeah. That is the parallel I'm making.
A little hand waving, like, everything's fine.
Everything's fine.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here.
Don't worry. Yep. You're perfectly safe.
Yep.
I've got you.
And Jurassic Park, as you know, means friendship.
Isla Nublar means friendship.
Yep. Well, that's probably as good a place to stop as any. We'll be back next time for our second part on Jurassic Park.
Yep.
And if you guys want to find where more discussion is happening, you can look for us on Facebook. Look for the Real Jaws Minute Facebook group. And we'll see you next time right here on the Real Jaws Minute.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.